On this episode of the podcast, Todd interviews Dr. Sean Allen, a practicing chiropractor and one half of the Gate Guys.
Guys, this is Todd from South Loop Strength and Conditioning, and I'm chatting today with Dr. Sean Allen. He's a chiropractor. He practices out in Westmont, which is a near suburb of Chicago, Illinois. And for people who don't know, Sean Allen is one half of the Gate Guys, which few folks have recommended the Gate Guys to me over the years for churning out some pretty impressive biomechanics related content. Obviously a lot of their stuff has to do with running and gait and the actual biomechanics of what happens through that process, but a lot of it is just two guys bouncing ideas back and forth in terms of training and rehab and the role of the nervous system in terms of motor control, and just like a lot of super dense backroom coach and treatment talk that a lot of it is dense enough that it's over my head, and I find that to be a great thing to listen to since it forces me to think hard and learn and look up stuff that I don't know. I've been listening to the Gate Guys podcast for quite a while now. Dr. Allen has treated me for some weird hip groin issues I've had from playing soccer. I had pretty good results with that, and we've scheduled the time to dig deep in some rabbit holes with the nervous system and training and form and all that type of stuff. So, Dr. Sean, thanks for coming on with me, man.
No problem, man. Hey, we've had an interesting little relationship in helping you work through some problems, and probably some of the most exciting conversations I've had in a little while with someone who isn't in the medical profession. But my God, Todd, you got some experience, and I'm sure your listeners know this, but some of my listeners, thousands of our listeners on our end are going to get this podcast because I'm going to cross-reference this over to our place. So I want you guys to know that Todd's got some deep knowledge. This guy, and so my turn to pat you on the back. This is a guy who is really intelligent, probably missed his calling for some medical stuff, but he's already blending that in, sneaking into some rather high-end seminars and absorbing material that people in my profession and Ivo's profession and in the therapy professions. Didn't you sneak into a Shirley Sarman seminar?
Yeah, I did, actually. It was great.
Yeah, that is, talk about drinking from a fire hose, so I applaud you.
I've always found that especially with a lot of the strength and conditioning stuff, I can go to that and I feel like I know a lot of it already. So It's like, okay, where am I going to find stuff that I don't know? And a lot of that has come through, physical therapy and rehab, continuing education stuff. And, it's one of those tricky things for a lot of strength coaches, because you get weirdos who think that all of a sudden they're a physical therapist because they did a few seminars and they're, trying to fix people's shoulder impingement and all that type of stuff. So there's definitely some sketchy stuff out there. But I just look at it as, a different lens to view training and how the body moves and how people control movement and all that type of stuff that has added a lot as far as, the strength and conditioning stuff that we can do.
Yeah, it really is about that. It's about the expansion of knowledge. And, if you're on that journey, as I know you are and a lot of the listeners are here, it's about, expanding what you know and learning a little bit more and putting the pieces together. I guess my concern is always, as yours is knowing boundaries and knowing the limits of that knowledge and knowing kind of where you've stepped outside that boundary and knowing that you're maybe kind of playing with some things that you don't really know. And that's a hard call to make, because we all tend to, hey, I got an idea what this is. Let me try this. And most of the time that leads to just, experience and knowledge just from playing around, and you learn by doing. It's one of my biggest beefs about the young lecturers and young professors or young teachers out there that have only been out for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. They don't have enough experience. And, I see a lot of seminars out there, people giving seminars, and I'm thinking, I like the idea of the content of that material, but I'm a little worried that from the experience side, there might be something a little lacking there. And I'm sure that might sound a little bit egoic and whatnot, but, there's a lot of stuff, as we all see on the internet, we watch videos and whatnot, and I'm sure you do it too, and I'm sure our listeners do too, that you watch a video and you go, I'm really not sure that they really understand that principle, or maybe they should have really rounded out that thought or this thought. And so it really, for an example, you know, there's the, and maybe this will go into a nice conversation. You know, the squat and the foot position, and that the knee should be over the foot. And that's something that's been, you know, pretty much a more common thought. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Is that still something?
People,
is that,
people always have an opinion about where the knee should be relative to the foot while the squatting.
Right. You know, and you get the side of, well, just where it goes naturally, or no, the knee should be moving over to the big toe or the second ray, the second toe, or it should be outside the foot. And, you know, it's just not that, you know, it's not about doing what looks right on your client a lot of the times. It's about what's right for your client. You know, if they've got a, you know, let's say they've got a rigid pes planus where the foot is collapsed and it's been collapsed for years and now it's a rigid deformity. And so they don't form an arch. They're kind of in permanent pronation. And, you know, that's going to drop the talus of the ankle medially. And that means that anytime they go ahead and dorsiflex with the ankle, that's going to create internal tibial spin and it's going to drag the knee inside the foot line. Well, certainly that client, you're going to want to tell them to keep their knees outside that, you know, on, at least on top of the foot or, you know, moving over the toes. But if they've got a rigid deformity, they're now going to be in a 4 foot var. So they're basically going to be standing on the outside of their foot. And along that line, what if they had, you know, internal tibial torsion or external tibial torsion, which is basically the normal anatomical development in some unfortunate individuals where the bones haven't completely derotated or, well, let's just say derotated back to their neutral alignment. So these are the clients that may look like they're duck-footed, meaning the feet are turned out or, as we like to say, an increased foot progression angle. And yet when you have them bend their knees with that foot position outwards, the knees go forward in the sagittal plane. And in those cases, if you had them move the knee outside the foot, you're going to create some knee pain. And I, as I always say, the knee kind of rules the roost. It's a sagittal hinging joint. Below it, you've got a multi-axial ankle and foot and ankle that moves both sagittally, frontally, and in rotation. And above it, you've got a hip joint that moves in the basic three cardinal planes. So the joint with the least limited range of motion is the knee. It's just a sagittal hinging joint. There's a trivial amount of rotation there, mind you, but it's certainly not worthy of, you know, creating an environment where you might prostitute that knee in order to get a better foot position or a better hip position. So, you know, that's a perfect example of, well, expand your knowledge a little bit and read about torsions, inversions, and femoral torsions and tibial torsions, and learn about, you know, what happens to the talus when you pronate and it drops and medially rotates and adducts, and it creates some eversion of the heel and the rear foot. If you understand that mechanical anatomy and how it functionally plays out when you put all three of those joints together, and then, God forbid, stack a weight on top of that pelvis and spine, you understand that maybe putting the foot or the knee over top of the foot in some clients could be devastating to them, and may cause cartilage wear, it may cause pain, it may cause reciprocal inhibition or tightness or protective movements, it may cause some hip impingement. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I don't want to go down that diatribe there, but the you know, it's about knowledge, as I said, as we started this little conversation. And so, you know, I applaud guys like you. And, you know, the thing that I really enjoyed about our conversation is that conversations previously is that you always seem to know where your limitation was. And, you know, I struggle with that because I have patients that come in and they've got clinical problems and things that I'm familiar with and maybe some things that I'm not so familiar with. And, you know, they want your help and they've been to a lot of places maybe. And so you want to throw some things out there. And, you know, the honest mind will probably say at times you may skirt some image, some ranges of your expertise zone or your comfort zone or your competence. And so I guess it's really good for us all, a message to us all, that we try to know what our limits are. And when you go to seminars, ask hard questions. If the professor can't answer them, maybe they're on that same journey. And I always like the people that say, I don't know. And so I'm never afraid to say that with my patients. But, you know, I'll tell them if I'm kind of skirting the limits of my knowledge base here and get their permission to let's play with this a little bit. But if it's causing some problems, we need to back away and maybe send you over to see someone who's got a little bit more experience with this type of a problem. So so that's a kind of a good way to start here. But you had mentioned the gate guys. We just recently launched our new site. We've been over on Tumblr, the blog there, for a long time, and we just launched the site.
With all the teens. All the teens are on Tumblr.
Yeah, we decided to keep the teens, but also to move over to the adult site. So so it's the Gate, G-A-I-T, not G-A-T-E and not anything else, thegateguys.com. We're all around Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. And you can find my personal site over at Dr. Allen. That's spelled out DOCTORALLEN.CO. And I just launched a personal site. So I'm going to throw that out there just as a personal plug. It's SeanAllen.net. And that's where I put some of my alternative writing. And, you know, I do dabble with a little bit of painting and stuff like that. So you can find all of my stuff there, and it's all cross-linked. So if you get to one of those sites, you'll get over to the Gate Guys, and you'll get over to some of this stuff. We've got 1,400 articles, over 1,400. So you can go into the search box and pretty much type in anything. And if it's movement-related or CrossFit or lifting or gait or running or biomechanics, we've probably written on it or at least touched on it. And if not, you send us an email. thegateguys@gmail.com, and Ivan and I will put our heads together and see if we can answer some questions for you.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, we started this off just kind of, you know, going down a rabbit hole on some biomechanics stuff, and I think that's one of the most interesting questions to discuss is just, you know, I'm looking at a lot of folks who are generally healthy, right? They're healthy people who are trying to work out or push their performance and all that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at a lot of folks who are coming to you because they have some sort of problem, right? They're injured or they're not where they want to be and all that type of stuff. So even though we may be looking at a lot of the same things in terms of movement quality, all that type of stuff, there's probably a little bit of a different bias there in terms of you see mostly injured people and I see mostly uninjured people. But I think that one of the things that, you know, it's really interesting, especially, you know, using this squat example you're talking about, is how do you actually balance the biomechanics of, say, someone with multiple, you know, movement issues like that are not easily correctable? Say someone has some sort of, you know, hip retroversion issue plus some sort of tibial torsion issue, and you just can't seem to quite make things happen properly. What do you use to sort of triage that and find trade-offs to make things work for them?
Well, I mean, that's the big question, right? And that's probably the biggest the problem that, you know, all of us deal with is, you know, what do I have in front of me? And, you know, one of the hard things I think you have the tougher job because you're going to have clients that come in and go, I want to be fit, I want to be healthy, I want to get stronger and faster. But I also have, you know, a bum shoulder. You know, I've been told I have a rotator cuff problem, but I've gone through a bunch of therapy, or, you know, I've kind of got a mildly degenerative right knee, or, you know, maybe I wear orthotics or what have you. I mean, so now you guys are automatically, they've thrown out this thing out there that, well, okay, is that my knowledge base there? And how do I deal with this? And how do I move around it? And so I think kind of what you're asking is what are you going to do with clients that come in with both anatomical asymmetries and functional asymmetries, right? That's kind of the heart of the question, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, because some stuff, you know, we take people through movement screens and try to figure out what's going on with them up front. Mm-hmm. And some of the stuff is pretty obviously, you know, tissue restriction or some sort of just basically, you know, stability control through specific joints. But other stuff seems to pretty obviously be more just like bony anatomical issues. And there's just a lot of trade-off there in terms of trying to get someone to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I mean, again, I think you guys have the harder job. I guess the issue is do you have enough knowledge to determine, is this functional or is it anatomical? I mean, how many folks out there, even in my profession or the therapy profession, can put someone on a table and do a little evaluation and say, hey, you have a little bit more external tibial torsion on your right leg, and you've got a little bit of hip retroversion on your left, and gosh, you put those things together, and you may get a pelvic distortion pattern, which is going to create some imbalances up into the spine and the pelvis, So, I mean, and we can go down that whole rabbit hole, but, you know, maybe you're dumping out of one glute into the quad and that's why they're getting knee pain. And, you know, the glute's not working on the other side, so the hamstring tone is coming up. It gets really muddied, and that's where the physical exam comes in. And so it's one of my concerns with all of the screens that are out there. And I applaud, you know, the big guy, Gray Cook out there, because he says, look, it's just a screen. It's a starting point. It's, as I say, it's information. Everything's information. And so I always say on our podcast that one of our beefs with gait analysis, for example, let's just start there. When you watch someone walk, you're not seeing what's wrong with them. You're seeing how they move around what limitations they have and around what tissues and muscles are working appropriately. So basically what you're seeing is you're seeing their compensations around any limitations that they have. It's one of my concerns with the screens, whether it's FMS or anything like that, is that you can't take it as gospel, because what shows up on the screen is what your client can do. It also is what they can't do, but it doesn't tell you what's wrong with them. It doesn't tell you that, you know, the first and second rectus on the left side isn't working, and so they're dumping the pelvis into an anterior pelvic tilt, and that's why the medial hamstring has a little bit more tone in it. It's why they can't recruit the glute all the way into a lunge. It's why they spin the leg out a little bit more during the squat, because they can't find all of the glutes, so they try and turn out a little bit more to try and find, you know, some lateral quadriceps or the iliac division of the glute max. So it gets really polluted the further you go down, and it really is a rabbit hole, and it's one of my favorite words, because if you don't know what information is going into and causing that patient or client, if you will, their movement pattern and how they move, you're not going to know what the screen means. And so it gives you information, but I always say the screen or the gait analysis or whatever you do is a piece of the puzzle. You then have to put the patient on the table and learn to evaluate each joint. Do they have enough big toe dorsiflexion? Do they have enough ankle dorsiflexion or ankle rocker? You know, do they have a limitation in knee hyperextension? Are they in fixed knee flexion because they had a knee replacement or an ACL or whatever? Do they have enough hip internal rotation and external rotation? Do they have enough hip flexion and extension? Do they have enough abduction, adduction at the hip? So you have to then go, okay, that's what I see on the exam. This is what's true. This is what's honest in terms of a static evaluation. Yeah, it has its limitations because the patient's lying on the table. They're not weight-bearing. They're not in the gravitational plane in their functional positioning. I get all that. But look, it's not a perfect world. You can't muscle test a lot of people standing up in a functional position. There's only so many things you can do. So that's where the screens come in. They say, well, what can you do when you're in the gravitational plane? How are you moving? And so you have to blend both of them together. Otherwise, the screen just tells you what they're having troubles with or what they're really good at. If you base a workout off of that, then you may be actually adding a compensation or what you feel is strength or skill or endurance or power to a pattern that you see as a deficit in their screen. But you may actually just be adding a compensation onto the compensation they presented with, which doesn't actually address the problem. You're actually getting further from the solution. You're giving them, like I like to say, you're giving them a better sheet of armor, and they can cope with things. They feel stronger. But the risk in that is that you may be putting loads and power and strength and whatnot into a compensation pattern, which means you may be actually overloading synergists improperly, and you may be getting abnormalities between the agonists and the antagonists. You may be entertaining or asking them to recruit some aberrant movement patterns or motor patterns, if you will. And so now maybe you're actually are adding liability to your client. So they might be more economical because you've given their compensation pattern some better skills and some better strength and better endurance and power and all that, but you actually may have increased their liability. For example, because maybe the glute can't take the load, now you're overpowering the hamstring, or you're putting some of the load into the paraspinals on that side. Or maybe they're turning the foot out a little bit more to take that load because that's not a clean load. And so maybe that's where some of these injuries come from. So a lot of clients that come in to see me, at least from the higher end athletes, you know, from sprinters and lifters and wrestlers, et cetera, you know, they always ask, so how did my injury occur? I'm like, I don't know, but, you know, this pattern isn't clean and you don't have hip rotation here And I'm sure you're working this side out like you are the other side. And so you build some asymmetries very likely into your system. And I'll say that if I can see it, and I'll show them the asymmetry and say, we need to back you away and we need to clean up this pattern. We need to increase the strength in this pattern. We need to get you back into the glute on this side. So a lot of the times we do a lot of asymmetrical work with our clients to try and build that symmetry back up, clean out the pattern, try to give them the joint movements that are clean, whether it's internal hip rotation or what have you. And then move them through more functional patterns of loading, from taking them off the table, away from basic skills, moving them maybe into a chair to load some skills, and then into partial weight bearing and then full weight bearing. So that's kind of the process that I go through. And that's one of the, I guess, the concerns that I have, both in my work. Am I fixing the problem, or am I actually deepening their compensatory well of strategies to cope with this problem? And, you know, if people keep coming back with the same problem, you know, I'm obviously not hitting home, and maybe I'm actually not putting, you know, the corrective work where it should be. And so as I see your work and the personal trainers and whatnot, I really, it's hard because you guys have these screens, you have as much information as you can get. Guys like you are probably gleaning more information because a lot of this is just power of observation. But if you've got some hands-on skills and you can assess some of these movement patterns and look at joints and see where the impairments are, then you can actually kind of design a cleaner, you know, workout for them, and, you know, a cleaner experience for them, so that you're actually resolving some of the problems. But without the physical exam, I would really feel tied. You know, I'd feel handcuffed on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the questions ends up being, you know, if you see patterns that are off for some reason or another, especially as a, you know, a trainer or a coach who's dealing with someone who isn't necessarily in pain, is, okay, at what point do you restrict training that pattern? Yeah. At what point do you decide to try to work on that pattern? You know, how relevant are asymmetries that you see? Okay, cool, you have a weight shift when you squat, you know, does that mean I need to stop you from squatting? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're dealing with a non-painful client, how do you sort of figure out mm-hmm. where you should be messing around and where you should just kind of let them go?
Yeah, I mean, that's the golden question. And I don't know that I have that answer. I mean, it's going to be really hard. I mean, you can't be paralyzed and just be a deer in the headlights. You got to do something. Your client is there and they're looking for functional improvements. So you got to do the best you can. But that comes back to that whole expansion of knowledge thing that we started this thing out with, is you got to keep getting smarter. And unfortunately, without some kind of medical background and understanding some of these things, and I'm not saying medical school and go through chiropractic school or physical therapy school. I'm saying, hey, look, I mean, there's plenty of stuff. Let's face it. You can get as good, if not better, an education on the internet. The problem is knowing which videos and which things to read and which ones are, you know, people that should have maybe read a little bit more before they put that video out there. So that's one of the problems. And, you know, patient-wise, that's a big problem. People come in and they've already self-diagnosed. I'm like, show me the video you watch, because that's clearly not what I'm seeing here. So I mean, you know, it comes down to these asymmetries you're talking about, and are they relevant? Well, they are relevant, but in your client, is that asymmetry an anatomic one or is it a functional one? And I guess when should they be corrected or not corrected is the question you're asking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they may tell you there's a problem, and they may tell you that, you know, hey, look here. And obviously, as your skills grow, your ability to kind of tease out these asymmetries helps you a little bit. But I guess it really comes down to maybe the client. You have to define your client, and it's partly what they want to do. It's their age. Are they someone who wants to be out of pain? Are they someone who just wants to be fixed? I mean, you know, there's a difference between getting someone out of pain and actually remedying the underlying problem that drove that pain. So, you know, it's often, you know, I always use like a pebble in a shoe analogy, you know, when people come in and they want an orthotic, and I say, look, I can put a pebble in your shoe and make you walk differently. And you can learn to weight bear around that pebble a little bit differently in the shoe. That's a compensation. That's certainly not fixing a problem, but I could put it in the shoe in the right place to get you unloading the lateral aspect of your, you know, your knee joint. But I'd rather teach you some mechanical things to actually fix that. And, you know, some people will choose to use an orthotic. I choose to use, you know, some educational stuff and some foot exercises and getting them to learn how to load the pattern a little bit more. But, or you could take the pebble out, give them those mechanics, and give them something for life that is, you know, a little bit more permanent. You know, one of the problems with asymmetries, and often I would imagine by the time you guys see them, is that, and you hope not, but often it's probably that they've plowed a really deep field of asymmetries into their nervous system. And they've done it over and over again. So you got this really deeply plowed neurologic pattern that is just really, really well ingrained. And, you know, when you ask them to load, do this or do that or do a lunge or squat or whatever, that's the way they load. And if it's not painful, is it a problem? Should you fix it? Well, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, if it's not a problem, leave it alone. But there's also that, well, how long can you do this and how many cycles of loading can he or she do this before we actually start having the system fall apart? So, you know, the goal is always to try and figure out the source of the problem. Okay. And I don't want this to be a whole talk about, you know, you need to have better hands-on skills. We all do, myself included. But you need to understand what a cleaner pattern is, and you need to see if they can achieve what looks like a cleaner pattern, and have them do it functionally well, and then have them do it with good skill, and then have them do it many, many times. We call that the endurance phase. That's building up durability on repetition. And then we eventually go into strength to clean up that pattern. Then you can add, you know, ballistic loads and jumping and stuff and power and whatnot like that and impact loading. So we have the skill, endurance, and strength. I often always say SES, skill, endurance, and strength. And you can add your more functional loading patterns of power and whatnot into that. And so you have to do that enough times that you can start to drive a more clean neurologic pattern. And it depends on what source that you look at and read, but, you know, it's anywhere from 10 to 12 weeks on average. So it's about 3 months or so of doing it clean enough and enough times that you can start to increase and start stacking more complex, you know, compound movements on top of that pattern. It doesn't mean you can't start sooner, but you got to at least have a good skill and build some endurance on that, and then add strength. And then what I say is add a new skill, add endurance, and add more strength on that, and then rinse and repeat again. So you keep upping the skill and then getting more repetition, endurance, and durability on that skill, increasing the capacity of the body's ability to do that more cleanly. And then you just keep recycling through that. And at some point, you have to actually, you know, give them something that's sport-specific, which is what you guys are just fantastic at, is teaching them how to load this stuff in more functional movements that are a little bit more challenging. So, you know, and it becomes difficult because when you start to add more functional compound movements, you're kind of dual-tasking. And we've written a lot of blog posts on dual-tasking, and that the, you know, as soon as you add a distractor, you change the focus away from that. So if you don't have, you know, that pattern down, that skill, that endurance and strength, and you add a distraction, whether that's a weight in a hand, or you're doing a farmer's carry, or you're doing, you know, whatever, you may actually see them dump back into the old pattern because it's the new task is distracting. So now they're focusing on that and they're going back into the primitive pattern that might have been more dysfunctional. So you have to make sure that you're rooted in that. It doesn't mean they can't do the farmer's carry, but you got to keep cueing them on, you know, load that left side, stacking the hip over the knee and the knee over the foot while you do the farmer's carry. So it's about teaching these dual tasks and starting to repetit. I always call it like juggling. You know, I'll throw you one ball today. I'll throw you two the next time. I'll throw you three the next time. You know, you have to just basically earn it each time so that we can keep stacking functional movements on there. But these asymmetries are killers. It's what I do all day long, because most people that come in have either an injury or they've had an older injury that leads them towards this compensatory pattern, especially if they haven't had the problem either addressed or completely rehabilitated. You know, someone can come in at 90% rehabbed on a knee or a foot or an ankle or hip, and, you know, they won't have any complaints, but in their history, they mentioned, you know, I had, you know, an ACL reconstruction, or I had a hip joint resurfacing, or what have you, or a labral amendment. And, you know, you start to test them, and you realize, wow, they've lost, you know, 10 degrees of internal rotation. I guess they're not using it during the day because that's not coming out and playing a physical limitation that's creating a problem. But if we go further along here, I need to, in terms of having them work out, you know, they're going to a CrossFit box or they're going over to Orange Theory or whatever. You have to clean up that pattern, or they're eventually going to come out and have some problems with that, or they may. There's no predictor on that, but there's some assumptions. So
sure. So if you know, we sort of look at this concept you're talking about of the skill, endurance, strength, I think that that's one of the most interesting things is how you sort of level that up for someone, right? Because mm-hmm. I think that something that I see and that I struggle with is taking the retraining of someone's movement pattern, right, in sort of a more corrective scenario or like a low load scenario or, mm-hmm. okay, cool, we're going to work on scapular positioning, you know, with this corrective exercise. But then as soon as you try to do a muscle up, it just is completely out the window and you just go mm-hmm. right back to what you were doing. Right. So, I mean, do you have maybe, you know, an example or like a type of thought process you would go through for like a progression for someone to go from like, okay, we're retraining this pattern in a basic sense to you're going to mm-hmm. actually do it with whatever yeah. your activity of choice is?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And along those lines, I mean, you add the skill. That's a lot of that first couple weeks of coordination. That's the first strength that the client's going to sense is very short term. Now, we know we're not going to produce strength during the first 2 weeks, but the client's going to feel stronger because they're more coordinated in that pattern. And then you go into the aerobic mitochondrial type phase, which is the endurance. And then you go into the anaerobic, which is your strength. So there's actually a logical progression why it's skill, endurance, and strength, and why you don't start with strength if they can't do something cleanly or they can't do it a lot of times at a lower load. And so adding strength too quickly is the biggest problem, because if a client can't demonstrate good skill and good endurance, they're going to basically add a compensation pattern in order to muscle the load out. So it's really important as to why you actually have to start at a lower level, which I know you guys do and most people do. So an example, you know, let's look at the big one that I will see all the time. Do you have enough ankle rocker or dorsiflexion, and do you have enough hip extension? If you find it on the table that it's limited, you know, they can't fire the glute in a movement pattern off of just a simple muscle test. You do it in a couple different planes. Can they engage the glute in, you know, stability of that hip? Maybe it's just through a bridge or something like that. Then what I would do is you know, I'd make those corrective changes, trying to get them to activate that a little bit. I might look at, and put the patient prone on the table and look at their prone hip extension pattern and see if they're actually extending through the hip or are they extending through the low back, which is the big problem. Because if you can't extend through the hip joint itself and use the glute to do that, you may try to recruit some of the paraspinals or dump into an anterior pelvic tilt, which can drive back pain, especially in runners. So you may see that in some people that go into a deep squat and they're trying to power out of that and they don't have the glutes, so they dump into the anterior pelvic tilt position to try and recruit, you know, some paraspinals. So maybe what I would do is put them on their back and I have them put their feet close together. I call these marching bridges. And stop me if this is not what you're looking for. It's kind of hard to do conceptually.
This is perfect, right? It's just kind of like, what is the thought process? Yeah. How do you sort of escalate that? Because, I mean, I think everyone sort of intuitively understands that it's not just, okay, I'm going to do a bridge on the ground and then I'm going to sprint all out and I'm going to be fine. But
sure.
What does that process look like?
You know, and there's all kinds of, I mean, we all do these, you know, supine, bend your knees and do a bridge. And most of us can do it. But, you know, if you bring your feet really close to your butt and you go up into a bridge, you might feel that the quads are tight. And you may feel that as the quad tightness increases, you can't get you to a glute squeeze because you're dumping into an anterior pelvic tilt. And that's one thing I ask everybody to do, either supine or standing, is just go way far into an anterior pelvic tilt. Just really drop the front of that pelvis down. And I tell them, squeeze your glutes. And they all look at you and go, I can't squeeze my glutes. I said, yes, I know. So where is your hip extension going to come from? Well, it's going to come from your hamstrings, or it's probably going to come from your paraspinals into your lumbar spine. So then you have them go into a standing posterior tilt or on the table in the bridge position, and they're like, oh, that's more glute there. Oh, I don't feel it in my back. Okay, so let's take you through some movements now. So they're in a supine position. They're lying on their back. Their knees are bent, and they go up into a bridge. I have them put their feet together because the feet are right underneath the center of the mass of the body, all the way up through the umbilicus and through your nose. So I have them cross their arms so that they're not touching the table, so that their base of support is more narrow. And you can do this on the floor. And then I have them lift 1 foot, 1 inch. And I have them hold it for just a moment. And then I have them put the foot down, and then they pause for a moment. And it's very important that you pause in between because you want that client to find 50-50 again. Because what happens is if there is some instability, and we'll talk that in a minute, you get some rocking of the pelvis. So if you lift the other foot too quickly and you get into these marches real quickly, which a lot of people do, you're actually not feeling the actual weakness because you're already trading off the compensation into the other leg. So it's real important to put that foot down, pause for a minute, and you lift the other one. So this is, you're in a sustained bridge, and I like to do a low bridge and then a high bridge. And so in the low bridge, can you get into your glutes And a lot of clients will say, oh, man, I feel my hamstring kicking in. I'm like, okay, so that's a synergist. That's kicking in because your glute's inhibited. But you're also in this posterior pelvic tilt position. Do you feel the quads a little bit tight? Yeah, I feel the quads a little bit tight. Okay, so let's drop you out of that bridge a little bit lower. Get out of that quad tightness so you can feel your glute. Did the hamstring calm down? It did. Okay, so this is as far as you can work into your bridge. You can't go into, you know, one of my favorite guys, Brett Contreras's hip thrusters. If you do, you're probably going to be doing the hip thrusters through your back. Yeah, you're going to be using your glutes a little bit, but a lot of it's going to go into your back. So if you can't, that's a perfect example of, can you do it cleanly? Can you show me the skill? And you, as soon as you're out of that pattern, the pelvis dumps anteriorly. The tightness of the quad shuts down the glute. You're into your hamstring. The moment you do that, and you do it a lot, now you're grooving that abnormal pattern. So you back away, get the pattern clean, and just lots of reps. I don't care if it's a one-inch bridge up off the table. That's your homework. And if you're standing on the right leg and your left foot's in the air and that glute feels a little bit weaker, then that's your homework. You're going on that side. Yeah, it seems very remedial and dumbed down for a lot of patients. They're like, really? Seriously? That's my homework? That's all you're going to give me? Do you know how many miles I run each week? And do you know how many, you know, times I go over to the gym? And I said, I understand, but that's why you're in my office, because that is what you're driving into the system that's caused your back pain or your hip pain or your knee pain. So if we're going to fix this, we got to dial you back out. So here's where the hard part goes. First of all, the big mistake everybody does with that one is they do it too fast. And by the way, I'm putting together a series of videos that are going to be streaming on demand, and they're going to go through this stuff. I'll show it to you. I'll show my variations. I'll show you the peelbacks. I'll show you where patients cheat. And I'm going to be doing this on all kinds of different patterns and foot and gait stuff. So it's coming. I know I've been promising it for years, but I had to get these websites up, and I'll make a million excuses. Just, it's coming. So the next thing I'm going to have the patient do, after I tell them slow is the answer. If you do it quickly, you're not going to feel the weakness, because speed allows you to cheat through things. So you're going to start to separate the feet. So now what you're doing is you're slowly getting the feet wider so that the feet are underneath the knees and the knees are underneath the hips, which is the way you should walk. A lot of us get too narrow-based gait and get into what I like to call the crossover gait, and I'm not going to go down that rant, because just go on gate guys and type in crossover gate. There's videos, there's all kinds of articles. It's kind of one of our favorite topics. And that's about economy.
I am a personal crossover gate.
Yeah.
Master myself, I would say.
Good. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us are, we get lazy. That's that whole trade off between economy and liability. I'll let my runners who are high end marathoners or ultra marathoners get their feet really, really narrow. But at some point, if you spend too much time there, that economy is going to drop off through just fatigability and endurance, and now your liability increases. So you need to find out where that is and build up that durability where you can hang out at that high-end economy without actually having the liability, which leads to the injury. So in this exercise, I'll have the client slowly start increasing their foot width. And so I like to use a Pilates block, and I'll turn it on the narrow and use that as a spacer, because let's face it, if your client is doing these slowly and they're doing lots of them because they're trying to pound out repetition, they're eventually going to look for economy, because this is going to get hard as they start to fatigue, and they may start putting their feet closer together again. So if they insist on not using something because they think they can outthink this, I always tell them, if suddenly this exercise gets easy, please look down. If your feet are together, you're just cheating yourself. Okay, you're pounding repetition into a simple pattern, and you should be progressing yourself into something more aggressive or at least a little bit more difficult. So they slowly start to move the feet apart. Now, if you think about it, if your hip, your knee, and your foot are in the same plane and you're in a bridge and you lift that one foot that's 6 inches apart, there's going to be a lot of load. It's like, so let's say you're in a right bridge and you lift your left foot off the ground. If you don't have enough glute on that right glute and you don't have enough abdominal strength to help you stabilize and hamstring strength to stabilize over that hip, that left hip is going to start to rotate down to the table. And what is your brain going to do? It's going to say, how can we make this easier? Shift the hip and the core to the right to try and get that foot underneath the belly button again. So your brain's actually going to look for midline again, which is that whole crossover dialogue. So this is kind of my transition from teaching them how to do it in a simple position, because the next phase is going to be, how do we do this walking? How do we do this running? God forbid, you can't even do this on the table. How are you going to go out for a 10-mile run? Well, Mrs. Jones, you're probably still going to have your pain because I can't get you out of that. So you got two you know, choices, either not run or deal with it while we slowly build up your pattern here, but know that you're actually not helping the process. You're slowing it down. So that's just the marching bridge. I'll have them do it in a low bridge and a high bridge. Why a low bridge? Well, because when you put your foot in front of you, you're in a little bit of hip flexion. That's the low bridge. In a high bridge where your kind of shoulders, hips, and knees are all kind of in a nice straight plank type bridge position, that's a little bit more like mid stance where your body is right over top of your foot. And so I do that in a low bridge and I do it in a high bridge. You do it slowly. If you find a weak side, I may actually ask them just to put their elbows now down on the table, because remember they were crossed. Put the elbows down on the table. Use them as kind of assistive kickstands to help them clean the pattern up and push some clean repetitions into it, because they're going to fatigue really quickly and go into that crump pattern if you're not careful. So, and maybe we'll add some other things that are single leg glute related on that side. Maybe we'll enter into the frontal plane and try to give them a little bit more glute medius, because it will have some spillover into the glute max function in the stance phase of gait. So that's kind of a way that I might look at, well, okay, that's hip extension. Okay, these are all the factors that come in of hamstring, quad, you know, dialogue, and what's the centration of the hip joint, you know, how is the hip extensor, you know, primary agonist, the glute, how's that pairing up with the hip flexor, psoas major, minor, iliacus relationship, that both help centrate that hip in that socket. And if there's a disrelationship there through your muscle testing or through just this simple like marching bridge pattern that I like to use as a screen, and it's by certainly no means the gold standard, and it's not the go-to, and it's not going to work for everybody. But, you know, if you can't get good hit, all of these things going, maybe that's why they're getting anterior femoral impingement at the hip joint. You know, the labrum's getting destroyed because when they go into their squat, the hip's not centrating. They're not into their glutes. The tight quad is pulling them into an anterior pelvic tilt, and the hamstring's not firing at the right time. And, you know, so that's just an example of kind of how I think through things. And that's just, hey, we just did a bridge in the sagittal plane forward. What about posterior plane? What about side planes? What about rotation? So a lot of my exam is always about how are they moving sagittally, how are they moving frontally, and how do they move axially? Can they stabilize those planes? Can they show me good patterns that are clean on the table? Can they show me good functional patterns that are clean, you know, on the floor? And then that's where kind of that's where the easier work comes in once you identify those things, because once you've identified the beast, you know how to kind of tame it. So.
Sure, yeah. And I wanted to chime in on the high bridge and low bridge, since you had me do those. And it was interesting in that I really struggled in the low bridge position but didn't have too many issues in the high bridge position. So once I sort of like, you know, locked everything in and was really squeezing to get into full hip extension, I was able to stabilize without too much trouble. But in that kind of like half on position, I had nothing in my left side to do that.
Yeah, that tells me that the early stance phase of gait was more of a challenge to you, which is actually more vulnerable because that's where the impact load is. If you can get to mid stance and you're pretty clean, the rest is basically momentum after that, minus a couple issues. Do you have enough toe dorsiflexion and stuff like that? And that comes into things like lunges and running and whatnot. So, you know, there's another screen that I've been doing more lately, and you know, it's been a long time since I've been to a seminar, so some of these things may have creeped into CrossFit boxes or maybe into seminars or whatnot, and maybe other people have been doing this for 10 years and I'm actually, you know, prehistoric in what I think is something new. But I'll put someone in kind of the kneeling lunge positions. Well, you're on a mat, your right knee is on the floor, your left foot's in front of you, you look like you're in a lunge. You're not in an inline lunge, so the you're not like doing it on a line, and have them move the pelvis back a little bit, almost like you're sitting on that heel. Squeeze the glute, come up, and can you get that pelvis past the vertical line of the kneeling knee? Can you move into hip extension and keep your glute on? And it's amazing how many people can't keep the glute on and the lower ab on because of quad tightness. And as they move past that point where they're moving forward past that knee, the quad tightness and the lower abdominal weakness immediately shuts the glute down, and they feel like the glute starts to quiver. So that's a simple thing. I'll just have them repeat that over and over and over again, and suddenly they start grooving some more hip extension. It's a very, very safe pattern. They're kneeling. And sometimes that's just enough to get them back into it. And sometimes when the supine bridge doesn't work or the marching bridges don't work, I'll go to that. But sometimes the marching bridge is the first. I mean, there's no recipe, as you know. I mean, that's what makes this a difficult game, is each person is their own recipe. They come in with different body masses, different strength, different age, different endurance, different, you know, power output, muscle mass, different torsions, versions, etc. So it really gets to be a polluted mess. It's what makes this exciting, but also makes it horribly frustrating and difficult at times from someone like me who's been doing this for almost 20 years. So there are days where I feel completely incompetent. So don't feel that you're alone on this stuff, guys.
You kind of mentioned some of the, you know, biomechanics stuff, again, with the, you know, specific muscle activation and specific anatomical variations as far as bone position and structure and all that type of stuff. In general, it seems that a lot of what you do has a very biomechanics-based, you know, structure.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I think you even mentioned this on a recent podcast, there's a lot of pain science stuff out there, you know, showing that some people have pain without any sort of obvious biomechanical flaws when you do imaging, and that some people also have just horrible images, their discs are falling out and they have no cartilage but don't actually experience pain based upon that. You know, how do you sort of reconcile those two almost, you know, not necessarily contradictory perspectives, but that, you know, that there seems to be a lot going on there in terms of like where pain actually comes from, how much biomechanics actually cause pain, and, mm-hmm. and just that sort of whole chaotic mess there.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of those questions where I wish Ivo was on the phone here with me, because that's kind of where his, you know, his neurologic background goes into. But I mean, this is the rabbit hole again. There's just so many different sources. I mean, pain obviously is not good. Pain means that there's probably inflammation, tissue damage. You know, you can get pain from myofascial trigger points that can create these really obtuse, weird peripheral patterns of pain. There's pain from central sensitization. I'll talk about a case of that if we have time. There's pain from excessive muscle tension or contracture. It ligamentous creep, which is all of that kind of Robin McKenzie's work on mechanical deformation and that kind of stuff. You know, there's drugs. You can get pain from, you know, analgesic rebound. Patients come taking lots of pain meds. They go off of that. So there's a lot of different places pain can come from, you know, including bad posture, where there might be increased muscle tone on one side and ligamentous creep on another side, or and mechanical deformation of soft tissues. So, I mean, the pain one is a really, really, it's difficult. And unfortunately, that's one that just, it's always at the surface of what we do, isn't it? It's always, you know, at the root of your client of, you know, I'm having pain in my knee. I don't think I can do another squat. Maybe it's not a good idea. I mean, pain is a real, you got to listen to it. And if you're not, you're probably getting yourself or your client into a little bit of a conundrum and increasing some risk factors there. Pain always tells me that there's something not right there. There's something damaged. We're either compressing something. There's chemical irritation. There's mechanical irritation. So I tend to back away from that, because more pain is not more gain. And it actually probably creates enough neurologic inhibition and reciprocal inhibition around a joint that makes that joint now unstable. I mean, pain is a signal to the brain that says, warning, danger, unload that area. We don't like the rate of deformation. We don't like the load particularly. We don't like the plane that you're stabilizing in. And so whether it's from posture or the way that you're doing a lift or the way that you're moving, pain is kind of that check engine light. And if you ignore it, you may find yourself over in the ditch. But, you know, a lot of it comes down to, it's a product of aberrant mechanics a lot of the time. Now, is that immediate aberrant mechanics or is that long-term mechanics? You know, a lot of tissues have the number of cycles. I always talk about tissue tolerance. A muscle or a healthy tissue or ligament or tendon can take a lot of load a lot of times because it's got some resilience to it. It's healthy. It has some tolerance to loading. But you take a tissue, a joint, a tendon, a ligament, and you mechanically load it in an aberrant pattern enough times, that tissue is going to lose its tolerance. You may get some tendon insufficiency, which is kind of a stretch-like phenomenon. You may get some fatigability factors there. You may tap out its strength. You may develop some aberrant joint mechanics that allow that tendon or area to load differently. So I tend to lean away from those things and say, look, obviously there's something not right here. Let's take a step back and see what you aren't using and see what you aren't doing correctly. You know, I don't know if I'm answering your question here.
No, I mean, I think that that's, you know, that's super interesting. Yeah. Just to think about, okay, cool, there's all these different potential causes of pain, and that fundamentally the pain is going to be controlled by the nervous system, and that often there is some sort of biomechanical role that can trigger the pain response, but it can be triggered independent of that as well. So that, you know, there are these occasions where, for whatever reason, someone has experienced pain without necessarily having that biomechanical flaw. In other cases, you know, people have these flaws, but for whatever reason in them, it's just not actually triggering that pain response.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to have a biomechanical problem. I just had a lady in last week who long standing neck and shoulder pain, limited ranges of shoulder flexion. But there was clearly some biomechanical things, but you know what it turned out was that there was a long standing history of other injuries and headaches and visual problems that was causing central sensitization, or what we call wind up in the central nervous system. And so I took her over to see a friend of mine who's a functional neurologist, and we did some balance testing and found that her center of pressure was off. Well, what does that mean? It was basically an extension. So we put her on this device, and every time, you know, she closed her eyes, she would kind of fall backwards, like, you know, one of those trust tests where she would just start falling backwards, and she would catch herself at the point where her cervical paraspinal proprioceptive type mechanisms kicked in, her vestibular apparatus kicked in. She couldn't kick in the visual one because her eyes were closed, but her system basically found the righting mechanism, and you saw her kind of jerk back up over top of her feet again, and she was able to find her balance. How did she do that? She cranked her shoulders into like a pec contraction and protruded her chin forward. So she basically went into this huge forward momentum movement through contracting the anterior chest wall and the deep neck flexors and the cervical extensors to push the chin forward. So that was her way of writing this. And so lo and behold, we then started looking at some visual things and found out, oh, the visual center is actually driving some of this center of pressure, where she was basically having a misinterpretation of where her body was in space. And her solution, the misinterpretation was that she was always falling backwards. So her solution was to always go forward. So she was in a significant anterior pelvic tilt, like a sway back position that got her torso forward. She was in this shortened pec position. She couldn't do a chin up. She couldn't do an overhead press because she couldn't get enough shoulder flexion because her pecs were so tight. Her lats were so tight. So in this case, it was a central mechanism that was driving a biomechanical problem, which was driving pain. And in order to get her out of that loop, you got to fix the nervous system problem first, because, you know, you could pound all day and all year on her mechanical problems and try and strengthen them out of that pattern. You're not going to win, because her brain doesn't know where her feet are. It doesn't know where her center of pressure is. So it kind of gets squirrely when you start throwing the nervous system in there. And that's why I'm going through the Carrick program to slowly start to add a little bit of that to the puzzle. But, you know, it's one of those things, the further you go down that rabbit hole, you know, the deeper it gets. It reminds me of that that Terence McKenna quote that says, here, it's on my computer here, I put it over there. As the bonfires of knowledge grow brighter, the more the darkness is revealed to our startled eyes. That's by Terence McKenna. You know, kind of the smarter you get, the less you realize you know, you know?
Yeah. I'm certainly not a fan of a lot of, you know, quotes posted on Instagram and such, but I kind of like that one.
I think
that, you know, sort of what you're saying is that a lot of the stuff can, the causality can go both ways, right? So there's this challenge to really figure out, okay, which way is driving a potential issue. Is it nervous system controlled, or is it sort of a more local issue, or is it a local issue that's causing a nervous system issue that's causing another local issue, and that all those things are possible, and that, you know, really we're just kind of hairless apes, just like in 2001, banging sticks around and trying to figure out what's actually happening here.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and you can't take this so far that it scares you from actually taking a step forward. You have to do something. But I guess the more aware you are, perhaps the more safe you'll be. You know, I had an elite runner in, and I put this up on our Facebook page and on our blog just this week, a one of the fastest 1500 meter men of all time here in America, from 40 to 45 years of age. And he came in with this hot, and you can just check it out on the blog there, but he had a hot enlarged nodule on his Achilles tendon. It was the Achilles tendon itself. It wasn't actually a nodule. The whole Achilles was thickened. And he had top-end calf weakness strength, so he couldn't do a full-end calf raise. But when you laid him on the table, his glute was smaller on that side. And so the heel raises gave him pain, so I put him through the bridge and the lunge thing that we talked about here on this podcast and got him back into his glute. He could feel the glute firing, which he couldn't feel at the start, had him do a heel raise, and he didn't have any pain. Well, how's that happen? Well, he's sharing the load through perhaps more of a prime mover. Yeah, he still has to plantar flex through the ankle, but you know, you better be in some degree of hip extension while you're doing that. So you better have the glute on and increase some load through that whole posterior chain, glute down through hamstring and into the calf. So he had a little bit of help through the whole chain. But you know, and I didn't put the whole vicious cycle or loop on the blog post, but a well-read and intelligent reader put up there that, well, what if the actual weak glute caused the calf to not be able to do its job and the calf was having to work harder? It can go both ways, where the weak calf was causing the glute to weaken. I mean, it's one of those chicken or the egg things. And so the bottom line is we still got to fix both of them. And it'd be nice to know who started it. And sometimes the one that started it is the last one that gets better. Maybe you see the glute strength come back and the glute bulk comes back and the hip extension pattern comes back. The quad starts to link, then they can find pelvis neutral. But the last thing you end up fixing them, you know, four or five visits down the road, is you still see the calf is weak. Well, maybe you could probably think that the calf maybe started the whole thing, but you just never know. You know, it's one of those, you know, floating question marks that never gets answered. But that was a great case, and I'm going to follow it up with part two because they asked me to kind of, okay, go in the reverse process. How could this have all happened? So go in the other direction that rather than the one that I went down. So just so that you can see it from both sides. So we'll do that in a part two here in the coming days or weeks. So.
Sure. Yeah. To the chagrin of patients everywhere, you can't necessarily tell them exactly how they did whatever they did to themselves.
But, yeah.
So, I mean, you mentioned a little bit of muscle testing stuff, and I wanted to ask you about that since I know you employ that in your practice. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on it since, you know, it's one of those things. There's some kooky people out there doing weird stuff with it, but sort of empirically, there seems to be a lot of really fascinating stuff that happens when you can go through muscle testing and try to actually unravel what's going on with folks.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's a tool. It is not the way. And if it is your only tool, you've got a pretty shallow toolbox and you're only going to try to screw, you know, nails with a screwdriver and you're going to have a little bit of problem there. So it's a tool and it should be one of many in your toolbox. And it's my way of, you know, really what it is, muscle testing is a way to test the nervous system. You're really not muscle testing. You're seeing, can they engage a vector load? And that's, if you understand that that's what it is, you realize that it's not the muscle test that's important. It's the quality of their attempt. It's how they compensate. You know, do they, you know, dig their right elbow into the table when you test their glute medius? Do they arch their back? So for me at the beginning, and I went through Greg Roscoff's muscle activation program way back, I don't know, it was almost 10 years ago. And there's some new stuff out there. There's the Douglas Heel stuff, which is, you know, I've not been through it, so I can't say for sure, but it's certainly not 10 months of studying and, you know, 3-day weekend courses. So, but anyways, you get your information where you need it and apply it and find a way to use it accurately, and you go from there. And what I liked about Greg's course was that it was extremely broad. And I mean, you were testing individual lumbricals in the feet. You were testing the difference between the long and short extensors and flexors of the foot. And, you know, I suddenly understood why, you know, towel curls were idiotic and it had some significant limitations and possibly problems. So the muscle test is important. It's a way of testing a muscle. And I want to be clear, that's an inaccurate statement. It's not testing a muscle. It's testing the patient's ability to stabilize across a joint in a plane. So if I push down on the leg, and they're in a straight leg raise on their back, and they raise the leg up, and their knee is locked, and I push down, is that more rectus femoris than it is vastus intermedius? You know, if the foot's rotated out a little bit, did I pull in the vastus medialis, or, you know, did I pull in the sartorius or the gracilis or more of the adductor brevis or longus? You know, you can skew the positioning of a limb or the spine or whatever to isolate a little bit closer. And a lot of the books say, okay, this is the test for the coccygeal division of the glute max. Well, okay, I can see how you're kind of putting some of the other muscle divisions of the glute max at a disadvantage, but I'll bet you there's some radiation out into those. You know, Ivo always talks about this magical 15 degrees of overspill on either side, that when you do an isotonic contraction, in a sustained angle, there is a 15 degree overflow. So if you have a patient who's got a limited range of motion in a joint and you actually just do some isometric type loads there, you'll get a 15 degree spillover in either direction. So you'll actually get a 30 degree range, even though you actually worked at a single range of motion. And so the same radiation occurs in muscle tests. So I like to say that muscle tests, at least the way I do them, tests functional planes of stability over multiple joints, unless you've isolated joints, and it tests the patient's ability to stabilize. And it also, I'm looking for more so how the patient cheats on the table. Do they extend into an anterior pelvic tilt? You know, we've talked about, you know, in an anterior pelvic tilt, someone might not be able to get to the glute max, but that might be their pattern to try and find hip extension into the low back. But if I'm testing the glute max and it tests weak, or maybe test strong. Did it test strong because they tried to stabilize that with their paraspinals and quadratus lumborum? I really didn't test the glute max at all. I tested their compensation pattern then. So the muscle testing actually comes down to paying attention to, one, what you're doing, the plane that you're in, and how the patient is compensating on the table. Because remember, if they came in with a problem or pain, or if they're just a healthy athlete, they also have probably some embedded compensation strategies where they feel strong, where they feel safe, where they've got a good endurance. And you start to test them, they're going to go to those places. It may not be what you're looking to test. It's a way to kind of tease out some of their deficiencies and maybe figure out maybe why they don't have as much power, you know, at the bottom of the squat, or maybe why they can't finish off a chin up or something like that. So it allows you, it's a piece of information. And so that's the way I like to look at muscle tests. At the very beginning, it was very much more of a pure thing, because I think that's the way you need to learn things at the beginning, is very isolated and pure. But as I started going at it, I went, there's no way that was all quadratus lumborum. The patient was hanging onto the table. So maybe it was the lat that they were trying to hang onto the table with that's weak. You go up there and you test the lat and you go, oh my God, you weren't weak at all in your back. It was actually the lat, which comes down over the back into the ilium there, that was actually weak. So, oh, it's a shoulder problem. The patient goes, oh, well, you know, I have problems with pull-ups on that side or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, now you're down the right road. So it's a tool to kind of keep you on the road and to assess the road that the client is on. And I think if you try and make it anything more than that, you're fooling yourself and maybe actually, lying to the process.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that happens with, especially people who are good athletes too, is, you know, you get some guy squatting 500 pounds and someone tells him that he has weak glutes and he's like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
So you're not necessarily talking about, oh, it's testing weak, so the contractile potential of the muscle is weak. It's that... Mm-hmm. The nervous system doesn't know how to control the specific pattern at this angle. So it's more about what the nervous system attempts to do in order to resist a specific motion and what that compensatory pattern is. Not just like, oh, your glute is weak, so you need to do these specific exercises to cause the glute to contract. It's more about, okay, it doesn't like this pattern. Is that kind of the right way to look at it?
Yeah, and here's a perfect example. I treat a lot of long-distance runners, ultramarathoners, you know, people are doing the 100, 200 milers, and triathletes. These guys are putting a lot of volume in. They have huge quads, and they've got small glutes, and that's not the right, ratio, the right relationship. So they, instead of trying to control hip motion and stability through the glute, they actually try to do it through the quadricep. And, you know, knee extension, when done, will actually give you hip extension in a lot of positions. So you can start to cheat and find hip extension strategies through quadriceps, synergistic type patterns. So when the quad is in control of the hip, you actually can put yourself at risk. So let's say at the top of a deadlift or something like that, or you're powering up through the last little bit of a squat into hip extension. What if you dumped into an anterior pelvic tilt there, just like you were alluding to? You might not get the terminal extension out of the glute. You may be putting it into your quad and into your low back, which might be their back pain or their hip pain or their knee pain. So you're right. I mean, the client's going to go to where they feel strong. And if they've built good durability and strength and power on that aberrant pattern, they're probably going to be able to do it and do it pretty well. The question is, how many cycles can they do it before they break down? Or are they only working out every once in a while so they actually, the volume isn't high enough, or the, you know, the frequency isn't high enough that they're actually stressing the system? But, you know, at some point, most things are going to go when the load gets high enough or the repetitions get high enough. And that's usually where the system breaks down. And I mean, a lot of the times we don't get injured. And let's go back to runners. The problems come on at the end of the run when they're starting to fatigue. That's where you're truly seeing the breakdown. They're fine in the first 2 to 5 miles. It's the last part where they start to break down, where their mileage is getting up. We've got the Chicago Marathon here in 2 weeks or a week and a half. You know, and everybody's coming in and their system is taxed and they're not starting their taper soon enough because they got to get one more long run in. And this is where the problems are kicking in, because they're so fatigued, they can't recover, that the system is just basically working on this sheet of armor and hopes and prayers. And it's where the problems come in. And so fatigue is a big thing. And so that goes back to that endurance part of the skill, endurance and strength. Can you do it cleanly a lot of times, or at least enough times that it is going to get you through the task at hand? You know, you've got clients who do chin-ups. I mean, you know, and what happens when they're supposed to get 15 out on the third set and they can't? You know, you start to see all kinds of kipping, and you know, you see them trying to do a muscle up, and you see all kinds of aberrant patterns. That's where the injuries are going to occur, because the system isn't durable there, because that's not the way you do most of your reps, in that ugly fashion. So stop your clients before they get into those patterns and say, look, we're done. There's nothing good coming from that. So
yeah, and they don't always want to hear that either.
No.
It's sort of a misconstrued conception of what mental toughness means to people. You know, they think that it's all just pushing and going as hard as they can and as long as they can and never quitting and all that type of stuff. And right. You know, I think that gets a lot of folks in trouble, rather than recognizing that, you know, the people who have a good attitude towards things are able to step back and look at the whole process, rather than trying to make too much of one specific rep or training session.
Yeah. And I got to say, that's why, you know, I follow most of the CrossFit stuff on social media and the videos. And I got to tell you, I mean, if everybody is doing it like those instructors do, and I know guys like you do, I know the guy over at Burr Ridge CrossFit very well. If everybody's doing it the way you guys do and the videos are, I mean, you guys are just leading the pack here, man, because it's all about strict form. It's about being smart. It's not about being a hero and doing one more than the guy you were stacked up against. So, you know, I'm a big, big fan of CrossFit, because I think it's being done right. Is there problems with it? Yeah, there is. But there's problems in my profession. There's problems with chocolate. I mean, let's call it what it is. But it's being smart about it. And if you know where your risks are, I think you can play up to the reward. So.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think one of the other things too that gets people in trouble is just the distinction between competitive CrossFit and normal everyday people working out.
Exactly.
You know, it's the same type of thing where, you know, you can play catch in the backyard with your kids and you're not going to be at risk for concussions. But if you're stepping through the door to play in the NFL, you know, you sort of know what you're signing up for at some level.
Exactly.
So Dr. Allen, I think we've got, you know, a solid hour's worth of dense conversation. So let's wrap it up. Let people know again where to find you with your new website and you know, your favorite teens to follow on Tumblr and all that type of stuff.
I'm taking that site down now. So it's thegateguys, GAITGUIS, thegateguys.com, or thegateguys.tumblr.com for all you teeny boppers. And then we're at the Gate Guys on Twitter, Facebook, as much as that platform irks me. It's a place where a lot of us congregate and have our groups on there, which actually I get a lot out of the group. So I think there's a huge value in that. And that's kind of where I try to use it. So, but you can also get me at drallen.co. Ivo's over at summitchiropracticandrehab.com. And, you know, email us if you want to. thegateguys@gmail.com. I mean, if you just type in Gate Guys into Google, you're going to see the first 15 or 20 pages of just all the places you can find us. So a lot of people like our podcasts. They work out to them. They run on them. So we've got about 110 or 112 of those. We go through all kinds of different topics, very similar to this conversation. This was very enjoyable. I bet you Iva would have loved to have been on here. So
yeah, I was telling him. Highly recommend that anyone who is listening to this head over to the iTunes store podcast app of your choice and search The Gate Guys and hit subscribe. There's probably one episode every one or two episodes per month, and they're always there's always at least one or two super fascinating nuggets in there.
Thank you very much. Well, we're trying, and Ivan and I always say, look, we're just part of the learning group here, and we're on the journey too. And if we make mistakes, call us out on it, because I want to be smarter too. And you know, I'm tired of most days coming home going, why can't I get, you know, patient 1, 3, and 7 better? So it's what keeps me going. And it's actually why I like to collaborate with guys like you who actually have a different look at things and are able to help me with clients, you know, sending client down to you. I've got a couple that actually I have recommended to you guys over at your CrossFit place over there in the city, because they drive in to see me into the suburbs, and it doesn't make sense. And I feel safe with you. And I think that's part of it, is teaming up with people that have similar knowledge bases, or at least, you know, different tentacles of the bigger piece. So
for sure.